This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Garrison Keillor has a new novel called Love Me, and it's his first book of fiction since 1993 that isn't set in Lake Wobegon. Love Me is about a writer from Minnesota who has always dreamed of writing for The New Yorker. After his first novel becomes a surprise bestseller, he leaves Minnesota and his wife, moves to a Manhattan apartment, and fulfills his dream of writing for the magazine. But his second novel flops, he faces a colossal writer's block, and ends up writing a newspaper advice column. Garrison Keillor is, of course, the creator and host of public radio's A Prairie Home Companion, which often has sketches and monologues set in his fictional prairie town of Lake Wobegon. Several of his books have been bestsellers. He's also written for The New Yorker and The Atlantic. And he used to write an advice column for the online magazine Salon under the name Mr. Blue, the same pen name his character uses. Let's start with a reading from Love Me. In this chapter, the writer, Larry Wyler, has just moved to Manhattan and is beginning his first day at The New Yorker.
25 West 43rd Street, an address emblazoned in the brain of every ambitious young English major in America. We wrote the address on an envelope in big, neat block letters, on the odd chance that the editors might pay attention to neat handwriting, and carefully folded our neatly typed manuscript of Hollyhocks and sealed it and put it in the mailbox that we believed was the lucky mailbox for that day, maybe the downtown one, maybe the one on the corner by the school where children danced around waiting for their bus, and went home and daydreamed about the new life that would be ours when The New Yorker put its large hand on our little head and said, "You, my son, are worthy. Enter into the gates of literature. 1. Untold wealth. 2. Admiration of women. 3. Opportunities to travel. 4. Personal friendships with other writers. 5. Discounts on trips, automobiles, jewelry." What we did not enclose with the story was our cover letter. We debated whether to, and then nixed it. To the editors, "I suffer from chronic pain syndrome and can't eat and am all skin and bones, and the lone bright spot in my life is when I sit down with a tablet and ballpoint pen and write my stories. I enclose one that I worked on for almost 3 years. If you publish it, I will be the happiest boy in the USA. If you reject it, I will kill myself, maybe in the oven or else in the car with the engine running and the tailpipe plugged. In my pocket will be your rejection slip. Think about it, Larry Wyler."
That's Garrison Keillor reading from his new novel, Love Me. Garrison, when did you start reading The New Yorker, and what did it first mean to you?
I was 13 years old. My junior high school English teacher, Frain Anderson, lent me a copy. I'd never seen it before in my life. I sat and pored over it, and to me it was the most elegant thing I'd ever seen.
Is there anything about the style of writing that was different from anything you had ever seen before?
Well, looking back, I wonder if I didn't sort of conflate the writing with the advertisements, with the little notices up front for the jazz clubs where Blossom Dearie was playing, you know, somewhere in the East Side. It was just all kind of worked in together, the cartoons and everything. But I loved A.J. Liebling. To me, he stood out from the rest of them as somebody who could not possibly be from Minnesota. He was a true New Yorker to me. I didn't read The New Yorker in order to read memoirs about somebody's childhood on the Great Plains. I read it to find out about the big city itself, and he was a big city writer.
Well, that's the thing. When you started to strive to be published in The New Yorker, did you feel like you had to change your voice and become somebody who you weren't?
You know, if I'd been smarter, I would have done it. I mean, if I had thought that was the key, but I had no idea what my voice was, so I just wrote every sort of thing and packed it into envelopes and sent it east, and they bought a story of mine. back in 1969. They just bought it off the slush pile. It was almost a historic event at the magazine when this happened. After I went there and got an office there, people recalled this to me. And it happened so seldom.
What was the story?
It was a story called Local Family Makes Son Happy. And it was a tiny story. It probably was less than 250, no, about 300 words. And it was a story about a family who are worried about their teenage son and worried that he may be killed in a car crash. And so to keep him home and give him what all boys want, they hire a prostitute for him. And it all works out really well, and she cooks and everything. And the story ended up with a recipe for fancy eggs.
So what kind of letter did you get back from the New Yorker when they decided to publish this?
A brief letter on their creamy stationery from Roger Angel, which I read sitting on the front steps of my house about 85 times, and then never showed to anybody.
What did it say?
Roger Angel, who's still at the New Yorker, who's 81 years old, was a great letter writer, a great writer of encouraging letters to young writers. And so he began it with a paragraph, I'm sure, of fulsome praise about this wonderful piece I had written, and then a little paragraph about the other pieces that he had decided not to accept. And, you know, probably we're all wrong about this, but somehow they just seemed, you know, not to be quite right, not to be you at your best, and so forth. He was so great at turning down things and accepting things. And after you read a letter from Roger Angel, you really walked on air for probably 15 or 20 minutes.
In 1966, and this was, I think, before your article was accepted by The New Yorker, you went to, I think, The Atlantic, maybe The New Yorker, several other magazines and publishing houses, looking for work. Were you confident of yourself, or did you feel like you had to create a new personality for yourself as you were presenting yourself to all these important places?
Well, I thought I had constructed a pretty good personality for myself, but of course when you take the bus all the way out to New York, as I did, and you are living down on West 19th Street in what was then a pretty rough neighborhood in Chelsea, and you're hiking and taking the subway up to Midtown, and you spend a lot of time sitting waiting in lobbies, your carefully constructed persona starts to crack at the edges, and you really start to seem kind of needy and pitiful, I think. But nonetheless, they all did me the great favor of turning me down, which, as you look back, was, you know, the best thing that could have happened to you. Instead of getting a job as you were hoping as a researcher at Sports Illustrated, and to go to work in the hive of Time Inc. and spend the next 30 years filing clippings. Instead, you were released out into the world to be a writer, which was exactly the right thing, except you weren't smart enough to know it at the time.
Your character moves to New York after he makes a lot of money with his first book, but his wife doesn't want to go, so he goes alone. And his description of what the New Yorker is like sounds like it's based on your fantasies from when you were growing up in Minnesota, imagining what life in The New Yorker might have been like. So would you read us his description of life at The New Yorker on page 76?
You thought this sounded like fiction? You thought this, this didn't ring true to you? Let me read it to you and see if you don't change your mind about this.
Yeah. Man.
The magazine was a club like the U.S. Senate. And once you got in, you hobnobbed with everybody. There was no high-hatting, no stiff-arming the junior members, only a pleasant pool of amiability. E.B. White took me birdwatching, and E.M. Frimbo took me on the Bangor Night Mail, and Pauline Kael took me to movies. She always brought her own popcorn because theaters didn't use real butter. I played ping pong with S.J. Perlman. He said, "Stand up there and I'll whip the bejiggers out of you, you sullen peasant." The S.J. stands for San Juan, baby. You familiar with the word muerte? And after he whipped me, he adjusted his chapeau and loped away natty, cool, keen as a wolfhound, off to lunch with some lissom starlet and lure her back to his pied-à-terre at the San Moritz. J.F. Powers took me to his barber Joe around the corner from St. Ignatius. Salinger gave me his memoirs, a cardboard carton that weighed about 30 pounds. Sean dropped in. He was short, muscular, bald, with big hands. He said, "You sail?" I said, "I have." He said, "You're on."
So, Garrison, compare that to what you actually found at the New Yorker.
You expect me to tell you what I actually found? The years of neglect and suffering and misery, sitting in an anteroom, trying to wait to get in to see people? No. No, there was some truth to that. The New Yorker was a very congenial place. Some people were more congenial than others, but Joe Mitchell was a very nice guy. He loved to go to lunch, and he loved to regale people with stories about his pal, A.J. Liebling. And Brendan Gill was just the soul of amiability. There was no high-hatting on Brendan's part, and a lot of other people as well. It was the young, ambitious people who were cold and didn't have any time for him.
I'm wondering what it was like for you to be edited at The New Yorker. Your character is told by the editor, William Shawn, that his writing is fussy and girlish. I don't imagine you were told that.
What was it like to be edited by Mr. Shawn? He was a very careful editor. And the legend about William Shawn, which was absolute truth, was that he read and made his mark on everything that went into the magazine. Your editor, my editor, Roger Angel, read it, of course, and made his suggestions, and the copy editor made anonymous suggestions, and the grammarian, Eleanor Gould, made her suggestions in the margin, and then there were small, very neat suggestions for a change of word here, possibly adding a comma there, perhaps ridding one of this comma, and each one with the initials WS in a little box. It was really quite amazing to be edited by him. You accepted maybe a half, maybe a third of his suggestions and felt grateful for those, and there was no problem in turning down the ones you turned down. He was a great, great editor, and how he ever did all of that work and still lead a life, I have no idea.
Did you stop writing for The New Yorker when the editor changed?
I packed up my office and moved all the books out one day when I heard that Tina Brown had been appointed the new editor of The New Yorker. It took me about 5 minutes to think about this, and I simply did it. There was a new regime coming in, and it wasn't one that I was sympathetic to, and I thought there are other things to do in life.
Now, your character starts writing an advice column for a Minneapolis paper, and it's the only thing he can write. He's totally blocked when it comes to his fiction, but he can write this advice column. Yeah. And you actually wrote a column for Salon that has the same, under the same pen name that your character uses, Mr. Blue.
Mr. Blue.
And, you know, I liked your advice column in Salon. And I thought so.
Oh?
Yeah.
Oh, did you?
Here's an advice you gave one woman. I wrote this down,
yes,
so I could read it to you. And this is a woman who's feeling guilty about her 3-month affair, which she hasn't told her husband about. And you say to her that she might be in need of some simple narrative therapy. You say, "See a psychologist and tell the whole story. It can ease your spirit to hear it come out of your own mouth and bounce off the walls and not be resonating and resonating in your head." And reading that, I thought, well, you know, that's interesting that you see therapy as being narrative therapy, about telling your story. And what do you think is helpful about that?
Well, I've never been in therapy, so I don't know. I'm surmising that the reason you pay that other person to sit there in the dim light with the legal pad on their lap is so that you tell your story. And that's the reason for the sort of open-ended questioning of therapists. I only know about this from, you know, reading Woody Allen and from New Yorker cartoons, but this is what I surmise. You surely don't expect this person to say wise things to you or to lead you towards some wisdom that is not already there in your head. So you must be there so that you can tell your story. And once you get it outside of yourself, then you are better able to see it. And perhaps you are better able to see how ordinary it is. What in the mists of your own imagination seemed to be a very dramatic, very profoundly disturbing story, when it comes out of your mouth and hangs there in the air, it's really kind of every day.
When you were asked to write an advice column for Salon, did you think, oh, this is another thing I'm being asked to do because I'm a celebrity and I get asked to do all kinds of things that, you know, aren't really designed for me?
They wanted me to write a column about politics. I thought, that is way too much work, and I don't know enough. I don't know anything, and I don't want to write about politics. So I suggested that I write an advice column. They were a little uncertain about that, but I felt there was a real niche here, and I still do. Advice columns tend to be written by women, and I think that women need to hear a man talk about these very same romantic situations and family problems and how do I find somebody to be in love with? I'm 48 years old, and I have a good job, and I own my own home, and I have a lot of friends, and my friends say I'm fun to be with, and I'm fairly good-looking, and why can't I find somebody who will love me and let me love them? I think a man's point of view should be heard on these things, particularly by women.
I'm guessing here, but I'm guessing that in your private life you weren't known as the person that everybody goes to for advice about their messy emotional lives. What made you think that you could actually do this?
People don't come to me in real life and ask because I am a writer, and they don't trust writers. They know that writers have no scruples when it comes to good material, and they could pour out their little heart to me, and 2 weeks later on a Saturday, they would hear the essence of their story done up in a Guy Noir episode. So that's why people don't in real life. But I felt that I could do this, and I found it to be a great column to do.
One last question: is doing Prairie Home Companion still fun for you? If it ever was fun in that sense, it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of fun. It's a very sociable show to do, and we have a very capable crew, I find it very congenial to be around them, the technical people and the backstage people and so forth, and I like that. But I'm looking forward to this next season, and I am in the process of trying to put together something I've never had before, and that is a cast of writers, and to have a bunch of writers around who will work on this. Comedy belongs in large part, I think, to young people, and I am looking at people who are in their early and mid 20s, and I've found some wonderful people, and so I'm looking forward to that and moving into a gray eminence stage of life, and having these people do the heavy lifting. And
so they'd be writing sketches or writing your monologues too?
Oh, they'll write sketches. I want them to write sketches. And, I want to make a half-hour radio drama series out of Guy Noir, Private Eye, so he can go off on his own and solve crimes among the well-to-do, and then create a new series of sketches on the show, and just keep on working in behalf of Bebop, Rebop, Rhubarb Pie, and the Ketchup Advisory Board, and the American Duct Tape Council, and all of our other generous sponsors.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Garrison Keillor's new novel is called Love Me.